Welcome back to the Motherload Show. I'm Jackson Dunn, here with you for another week of the podcast. Now, of course, I've been talking a little bit about creation and evolution. That was on last week's podcast, Planet of the Apes. So if you haven't listened to that, you can run back and listen to that on the podcast website. You can go to anchor.fm/motherload or just look up The Motherload Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. But generally, the idea is, just for a quick recap, if you don't want to go back and listen, there are two theories about the way the world was created. The traditional one that you may have learned in school is evolutionism. The idea that animals of a lower level, such as bacteria and very simple cells, have evolved into the higher life forms, such as humans, that we see today. Now, the idea of creation is actually the older theory, the idea that God created, or an intelligent design, created the universe. But what's interesting is, in the light of modern science, and I'm not talking about modern teaching of science, but the ideas of modern discoveries, such as the discovery of DNA, the theory of creation, while largely discounted by the scientific community, actually should be looked at again, because it should be gaining credence. Because surprisingly, evidence seems to bear out this theory. And I would also suggest that the reason we don't hear more about the theory of creation is because a lot of the scientific writers have a religious or political axe to grind. Now, to hear a little bit more about the political history of creation versus evolution and the debate, that's last week's episode. This week, I'm going to go into a little more of the scientific basis for why I say what I say, why I believe that creationism is the more realistic theory of the way that the world came about. Now, the thing is, we often are taught science in terms of what is common knowledge or is commonly believed by scientists. But this is not exactly science. Science is actually a method of testing whether or not something is true. So generally, the way that science works, and of course many of you know this, that an experiment is proposed and an idea called a hypothesis is given for how that experiment should turn out. For instance, you can make a very simple experiment. You can say that you mix baking soda and vinegar. Now, all of you know what will happen. There will be a chemical reaction. The baking soda and vinegar will bubble up, and you've seen it probably in 1,000 science experiment volcanoes that are taught at, you know, little kids' schools. But you can make the hypothesis, if that was a scientific experiment, that there would be that chemical reaction. And if you poured that vinegar and that baking soda together and saw how it turned out, you'd be right. The thing is, the method is to first propose an experiment, to make a guess about how that experiment will turn out, and then to see if you can prove your first guess wrong. If you can't prove it wrong, that fact is generally an accepted fact. Now, understood that you cannot prove anything right using science. And this is the problem for a lot of people who understand the ideas of science, but not really the way in which the theory itself works. You can't prove something right with science. For instance, we can say that there's gravity on the Earth, because we can prove wrong anyone who says that we'll float away into the atmosphere. But we can't prove that gravity will work in every single case, because there are some cases in which gravity can be overcome by other forces, and it's hard for us to determine, oh, gravity works in every situation. For instance, in the middle of space, gravity does not work. But we can prove ourselves wrong to say that we're going to float up if we're standing on the Earth, because gravity is holding us. It's a very subtle change to say that you can only prove something wrong with science, and you can usually formulate a question so that you can prove something right by reason of proving something else wrong. For instance, I can prove right that if I jump, I'll fall, by proving wrong that if I jump, I'll float. But it doesn't work the opposite way. I can't prove something right perfectly every time. And this has been seen in a lot of failed scientific theories. that people used to believe, for instance, that flies were automatically generated from swamps. They believed that flies were basically evolved from swamps. This was maybe in like the 1500s or 1600s. And over they would do these tests where they would prove that, yes, flies are coming out of swamps. So that was considered the accepted theory, and people thought that they could prove that that happened. Later on, scientists were able to prove them wrong using more updated methods in which they kept other flies from laying eggs into the swamp. And suddenly they realized that, nope, flies don't come from swamps. Flies come from fly eggs, which are laid in swamps. Anyway, this is how we have to look at science, that we're always trying to prove scientific guesses, theories, wrong, not trying to prove things right. Here's the problem. If you look at the media, and especially in the case of the creation versus evolution debate, you'll often hear people talk about the theory of evolution as fact. And oftentimes they kind of rail against those who say that they are creationist, because creationists hold a different view, a different guess on how the world works. And they say, oh, that's debunked, and evolution is right. But that's not how science works. You can't prove evolution right. You can prove something else wrong, but you can't prove evolution right. And the problem is, in the case of creation versus evolution, none of us were there at the beginning of the earth. So it's very difficult to prove one side wrong or one side right. Now, there can be evidence that points towards one side, and you can prove certain things wrong, but you will never be able to prove without a shadow of a doubt that evolution is the way that this earth came about, or that intelligent design, a creator, wasn't involved in the making of the world. But of course, we can say, oh, you can't prove one or the other, and just leave it at that, but that isn't really very intellectually honest of somebody who believes different than the standard, which is, of course, evolution. The reason why? Because why would you change your mind? Why would you change your opinion just because you can't prove it with beyond a shadow of a doubt? You can prove it reasonably, or maybe you assume that you can prove it reasonably because scientists have told you over and over and over, evolution is a fact. Here's the problem. There are a lot of holes in the theory of evolution that scientists don't talk about. And this is the reason that there are evolutionary scientists and researchers today who are working every day for their entire lives trying to figure out the mechanisms by which evolution could possibly work. In the same vein, there are creationist scientists who try to figure out in every possible way how intelligent design could work. And while it is a much less dominant theory than evolution, the science behind it is just as real. And it is distinguished from something like a flat earth theory, which is more of a conspiracy theory, by the fact that the flat earth theory, if it's a guess for how the world works, has been proven wrong, because we've been able to send even people up into space to see the world, right? We are able to send people up into space. We're able to send satellites up into space. Even a person who isn't the most scientifically literate, even a person who isn't part of the government, can do experiments to show that the Earth indeed does have a curvature, right? It's not just a flat disk. And the problem is that a lot of times people will equate the theory of creationism, where we're not able to get any direct evidence because we weren't there at the beginning of the earth, with something like a conspiracy theory, a flat earth conspiracy theory, and they pish posh, it's foolery and it's nothing. But a lot of them don't realize that evolutionary science is not as settled as people would like to believe that it is. One of the things that I think is most compelling that tells me that there is a problem with the idea of evolution as we know it today is something that I learned in mathematics. The idea is called limits. Now, I'm not going to bore you on all the details, and if you're not familiar with calculus, you might not understand them anyway. But the basic idea is that things will get less energetic over time. For instance, I talked about this last week a little bit. if you drop something, it will never go up into space, right? It will go down towards the ground. And the reason it will do that is because it loses energy by going down to the ground. And things will always attempt to go to the lowest energy possible. This is why we as humans are lazy. We don't want to do extra work. We don't want to go to the gym because it is difficult for our muscles to fight against putting energy in. It has to burn off calories. It has to burn off food to be able to create that energy, and things don't naturally go that direction. This is something that is about as close to a proven fact as we can come to in our modern scientific theory, where you can't ever prove anything right. But we call this the law of entropy, that things will either stay unchanged or will become lower energy over time, but things won't spontaneously gain energy. If you sit on the couch and you never move, you will never spontaneously gain food into your system, right? You'll lose food and then you'll get hungry. You'll grab your bag of potato chips if you're like me, and you'll sit back down on the couch. But that's the thing. Things will never go back to a lower energy state. The problem is, if there is no intelligent designer to our universe, that means that our universe has been losing energy since its very beginning. And the problem is, scientists don't know where the universe began. Indeed, evidence would point toward the fact that our universe never really had a beginning, even before the Big Bang that they talk about. There had to be some amount of energy, either finite or infinite, that was around forever. But the problem is this. If things are around forever, they will tend to lose energy. This is as close to a scientific proven fact as we can get. While, of course, I can't prove that beyond a shadow of a doubt, because nobody can, right? I can't even prove that 2 plus 2 is 4 beyond a shadow of a doubt. I can say it's obvious, but I can't prove it. I can show you how it's done on paper. I can show you how it's done with beans or whatever you want to count, but I can't really prove it. But it's basically as proven as 2 plus 2 is 4 that things will either stay the same or lose energy over time. The problem is, if our universe has been losing energy over time infinitely, then we should see no energy in the earth, in the world, or we should see an infinite amount of energy, so that even if it was losing energy over time, we still see energy in our universe today. It's not all disappeared. In the same law of entropy, not only do things generally go to a lower energy state, but they also become more disorderly, right? You'll never see, like, for instance, if you start a bomb off, you'll never see that suddenly buildings are built by the bomb. It will knock down buildings, but it will never build them back up again. So sometimes you can see small areas where something gets more orderly. For instance, if you knock down a power line, sometimes it will make crystals out of the sand when the electricity shoots through it. But in general, you've lost energy because now the electric pole is down. You've lost all the energy out of the wire. All of that stuff. So basically the idea is you will continually lose energy. But the problem is that's not what we see in our universe. We see a very definite order in the way the universe is set up. Specifically, we see that on Earth, where our life forms are incredibly complex. And complexity takes energy. Things don't go from a lower complexity to a higher complexity without massive amounts of energy. And the problem is that even though you have that energy, you also have to be able to direct that energy to create things that are of higher order. There's a very simple thought experiment that's often used by creation scientists, and they say this: put a bunch of watch parts, all the watch parts that are needed to make a perfectly functioning, you know, spring wound up 1800 style watch, right? A little mechanical watch. Put them all together into a little bag, start shaking that bag. You can shake that bag and shake that bag and shake that bag, but you're never going to reassemble a watch by shaking the bag, right? You have to put in some type of intelligent direction to your energy, like setting one gear on top of the next gear and then setting the springs in the spot for the spring to be able to create that watch again. If you just shake the bag over and over and over, you'll end up breaking the parts for the watch. And that's basically what we see with the mathematics of the universe. This has been a real problem for scientists who continually have to try to postulate theories again, theories, educated guesses on how the world is set up, they have to continually postulate theories that allow them to overcome this mathematics barrier. And the problem is, it's more significant than most people realize. It's on the order of sextillions, not millions, not billions, not even quadrillions, but like six orders of magnitude higher than like billions, that we're seeing a chance, even a chance, with the idea that they have, the leading theories that they have for the creation of life, that life would be created in not just some other random assortment of chemicals. And here's the problem. The mathematics don't really work out, so that when we talk about whether or not life could have started in the first place, and this is before we even get to the monkeys to men type of evolution that we talk about in schools today, the mathematics are strongly against it. And because there isn't that directed energy, because evolutionary scientists don't believe that it came from God, even if there wasn't that directed energy, the chances of the universe coming together into the order and the complexity that we see it are incredibly, exponentially, so small as to be, again, very close to mathematically impossible. Now remember that very close doesn't mean impossible, and this is why we can't ever prove something wrong, even, that we don't have direct evidence for. I'm not going to be able to go back in time and to see the way in which the world was created to prove that this is wrong. But the evidence does point against it. The other problem, well, actually, before I go on to that, there's another thought experiment that is actually pretty good, that helps you visualize the incredible scale of the mathematical probability that it would take for life to form on Earth. And one scientist actually ran the number calculations and then expressed it like this. If our whole entire solar system, that includes all the planets to Pluto, because it was in the solar system at the time he made this mathematical postulation, all of those planets, so distant that it takes light almost 13 minutes to travel from the sun all the way to the outer edge of our solar system, if that entire area was filled up with trillions upon trillions upon trillions of blind men shuffling Rubik's cubes in their hands, the chance of them getting all of those Rubik's cubes into their correct solution, you know, with each side a different color, all at the same moment, without being able to see or otherwise know what they're doing, just random shuffling, that's about the chance that there would be that life itself would be created due to random chance. And if you look at it that way, the trillions upon trillions and upon trillions, it's amazing. It's amazing to us when we see someone who randomly throws a ball behind their back from half court and shoots it, and it hits the basket. But think now about trillions upon trillions and upon trillions of those guys all randomly shooting behind them and all hitting the basket at the same time. Now think about the chance of that happening. It's not very good. But that's really the type of mathematical odds that are against the theory of evolution. And they don't tell you about this because, in terms of science, if something has a 95% chance of failing, it is generally considered a failure. But this doesn't have a 95% chance of failing. This has an almost infinitesimally small percent chance. I don't even know a number to really express how small, a percent chance of success. It's the opposite. The chance of evolution actually failing due to our known idea about how the universe must have existed if it would actually even happen, even if evolution would happen, are basically infinitesimally small. But let's say you got past that. Let's say that you beat all odds and suddenly life started on Earth. Then you have to look at the geological structure to maybe make a determination about whether or not evolution was really real. And this is where a lot of evolutionists really try to nail the coffin for creationists by saying, look, we see thousands and thousands of years, even millions of years worth of fossils. So what are you going to do? Tell us, prove to us that these the fossil record is wrong? And they've developed a lot of different systems in which to date these fossils from millions and millions, supposedly, of years ago. And generally, these dating methods, including what's called radiometric dating or C14 dating, carbon dating, are used. Now, to explain these in layman's terms, basically the idea is that radiation and radioactive substances, I should say, decompose over time. So generally speaking, if you had, let's say, a uranium bomb, like, for instance, you know, the United States detonated an atomic bomb over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. Over time, these radioactive substances will decay and will dissipate so that it is once again livable in those areas. It isn't just an area of nuclear waste, right? These cities are back again, and part of the reason is because the substances, these radioactive substances that make up these bombs, decay over time. And the way that basically they go about dating a lot of these bones that they see in the geological structure, these fossils, is they basically see how much of this radioactive substance animals take in modern days, and then test it against the amount of radioactive substance in the bones of those animals from ancient days. And then they can say, oh, look, there's this much of the chemical has decayed. And because the element decays at a very steady rate, for instance, there's one of these radioactive elements that decays about every 6 seconds, half of the element disappears and turns into other elements as it decays and shoots off little particles. That one, cesium-6 is the name of that one. But carbon-14, basically half of it will decay into other elements every about 14,000 years. And so basically they go back and say, oh, look, this one has 4 times or 8 times or 16 times less than an animal that we see today. And therefore, we can assume that it is 14 or 28,000 years old on and on until millions of years. The problem is that they have to make an assumption about what the animal was eating, the assumption about the conditions that the fossil has grown under. Because, for instance, as water washes on bones, it will leach chemicals out of the bones. They have to make assumptions about the type of atmospheric conditions. For instance, was there a lot of radioactivity coming from the sun at the time of these bones? The time that the animal died that made these fossils. They have to make all of those assumptions. And so when they say a set in stone, oh, it's 5.3 million years old, they've made a ton of assumptions about how they actually date that bone. Now, there are some problems because they've actually taken some bones of modern animals into the lab to scientists and basically told the scientists, oh, this bone was found in blankety blank place. And the scientist immediately will assume it's a fossil, right? And so he will assume it is, let's say, 28,000 years old based on other fossils that were found in the area. And then when he goes into the lab, he makes his assumptions and then comes out with, whoa, this animal is actually 28,000 years, it died 28,000 years ago. But it's actually a bone chip or a piece of a carcass from an animal that just died a couple days ago. There was actually one where they actually took a live mollusk from the bottom of the ocean, tested it using these radiometric dating methods, and came out with the fact that this animal was, I think it was 56,000 years old. Obviously ridiculous. You know, the animal is still alive. Even if you were talking about from the time that the animal actually started growing, maybe a year ago. So the methods are wildly inaccurate, and they get more and more inaccurate as you go out more and more years. It's very easy, it's much easier anyway, let's put it that way, to make assumptions about an animal that died yesterday right? And say, oh, this is 1 day old or 8 days old or a year old, right? Because you can make assumptions about the way in which it lived or the place in which it lived because you can observe those conditions. But as you get farther and farther, millions and millions of years ago, you don't really know what the conditions on Earth were. And for that reason, the dating methods are wildly inaccurate. And they've been proved time and time again as people date modern animals and come out with wildly inaccurate assumptions about the age in which they lived. So there is some problems with that geological idea. The other one that's a big problem is the fact that there are such stratified layers in geology. Now, this can be explained by certain types of seismic shift, where the plates, the tectonic plates of the Earth will shift and grind against each other and push up mountains over millions of years and et cetera, et cetera. But to make these assumptions, again, is very troubling, is very problematic, because you see very strange things sometimes, including animals that were obviously trapped very quickly. For instance, there are fossils of fish that are found that still have food in their mouths. And there are fossils of fish that obviously haven't decayed, right? That their skin is still intact in the fossil. So it got turned to stone suddenly before the fish had a chance to rot. There are also times when you find very, very strange things, such as on the top of the tallest mountains, you often find seashells. You're like, how is it possible to have seashells up there? Now, scientists would postulate that over millions of years, again, these tectonic plates have shifted and pushed dirt up into forming mountains, so that possibly what are mountains today were ocean floors millions of years ago. The problem is that if we're seeing these soft tissue animals in the same place as we're seeing sea creatures, right, that we're seeing fossils from the same geologic layers, we have to assume that it happened relatively quickly because of the ability for the soft tissue to stay in there. And so we have to assume that the geological structure has shifted much quicker than a lot of scientists would like to believe. Now, many creationists say that this was because of a worldwide flood. This is something that is a legend in virtually every culture on Earth, including, of course, Noah's Ark, which is the very famous biblical story of the flood. But this is not a story that is by any means only a biblical story. The Aztecs had their version of it. The Babylonians, their version of it. Basically, every culture on Earth, the Chinese also, they have their version. Every culture on Earth talks about a distant ancestor that went through a worldwide flood and came out and restarted humanity. Now, it's very funny that we have that, and it's kind of a side note. It's not really scientific evidence, but it is very funny that people that are all across the world, people who are really not that closely related to each other at all share one common origin story. And by the way, it was believed by most of those cultures until the era of modern science, where a lot more skepticism was brought in. But all of them had it. And so it makes one think, maybe there's some truth to that. But to get back to the scientific theory, the last one that I think is really important, and I talked a slight bit about it last week, but I'm going to get into just a bit more detail this time, is the idea of cladistics. Now, cladistics is the study of the genealogical record of how animals would have evolved, but it's based on DNA. Animals that are closer to each other in terms of what DNA they have are more likely related to each other. And there are very complicated ways to stratify these layers and to name them by families. For instance, families that are very similar, such as certain bacteria, all in the same family, like the family tree of animals, basically. But the idea of cladistics is that animals that have very close DNA probably evolved from each other. Here's the problem. There are a lot of animals that don't really have a problem. For instance, monkeys and men have bodies that are relatively similar to each other, right? We both have hands with thumbs. We both have some sort of feet. We both have the ability at least to walk upright. Now, humans, of course, are one of the only species that walk upright all of the time, but monkeys generally have the ability to do it, right? They have a very similar bone structure to us, and their DNA is very close to ours. Like, I think 99% of their DNA is seen in our DNA as well. Now, here's the thing. A lot of animals don't have that similarity, right? A lot of animals that are very closely related in terms of their DNA don't have a lot of functional similarities. And so the strange thing is, why did they evolve that way? For instance, why would a bird evolve from a fish? Because they live in very different areas of the environment. Animals that are very different from each other have very similar DNA. Actually kind of speaks against evolution, because why would they evolve to such drastic levels without some pressure from the environment to evolve to that drastic level? For instance, people say that the reason that we evolved from monkeys was because we had to become smarter and had to be able to use our intellect more to stay alive on Earth. This wouldn't be the case for a fish turning into a bird, however, because a fish has no reason to want to live in the air, right? It has a perfectly good ecosystem called the sea, right? It doesn't need to move anywhere. It would always go towards a more specialized version of fish if the idea of evolution was correct. And for this reason, cladistics, the study of the DNA, shows that we're closely related to animals that in traditional terms, in terms of the traditional evolution, where things will evolve to fit their environment, it doesn't make sense. So then you ask, why did we evolve from this? Was it just random chance that we're evolving in the way that we are? Why are our eyes the way they are? Because actually, if you look at very simple cells, they evolve eyes backwards. The part that senses light in our eyes is behind the lens of our eye, right? This is why you can change lens or possibly even get LASIK surgery to fix your lens, which is on the outside of your eye, which can help you see better. And it also protects the part that sees in the very back of our eye. This isn't seen in simple creatures. The opposite is seen, where the outside of the eye is the part that senses light. And they don't even really have an eye. It's very primitive. But why would it suddenly evolve to be in the back of our eye? Because if that happened, we wouldn't be able to see without a perfectly formed lens on the front of our eye. And how would nature know to create a lens? It doesn't make sense that without some kind of design, that random chance would dictate a complete reversal of the way our eye was evolving, and the addition of a completely new information, which is the lens above our eye, if the DNA method of transmission is correct. There are tons of these scientific holes. Really, there are scientific holes in the theory of evolution, where the theory of evolution sounds great on paper, but doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when you put it against the scientific method, where you can prove things wrong, but you can't necessarily prove your theory right. And more that we look at this, the theory of evolution, the more and more we realize that it came out of an 18th century, or rather a 19th century, it was really under Charles Darwin in the 1800s, a 19th century idea, a secularism, trying to get away from God and explain the world in a natural sense, but without a whole lot of knowledge of how nature actually worked. We see that evolution is basically based on this worldview, that it's almost a religious position, rather than following the scientific method of actually weighing the evidence. And by the way, all of the things I just talked about, creation doesn't have a problem with this, because they say that, look, nature is what it is. Nature can go so far. Nature can show us so much. But we can see in the incredible complexity of life, we can see that there was an intentional design by an intentional creator who is bigger and stronger than our Earth, who operates outside of the normal laws of physics as humans see them in our plane of reference today. If you can make that assumption, it's actually pretty easy to postulate rather strong theories for why we have the type of eyes we have, for why the geological structure is the geological structure that we see today. And also the mathematics work out a whole lot better. For that reason, don't consider, when you're looking at scientific materials, don't consider the theory of evolution as settled, because nothing in science is ever settled. Even a law of science can never be totally settled. But instead, look at things with a critical eye. Don't listen to those who would debunk a theory just because they have a worldview that needs it, that needs that naturalistic idea to feel right. Don't follow that, but instead follow the idea that you are supposed to critically understand the complexities of life, and that you should be doing science. You may not be a scientist, but you can prove things right and wrong by making educated guesses about your world and then opening your eyes to the evidence, not to the propaganda, but to the evidence. This is the Motherlode Show. I am Jackson Dunn. Thank you so much for joining me today. I went a little long. Thank you very much for bearing with me. I will be back next week. Another great episode here on the Motherlode Show.